Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ecocentrics. I'm Tom.
And I'm PK, and we're on a bit of a mission to live a low-carbon life.
But we know it isn't easy, and there's loads of information to wade through.
So every week, we scan through the climate news, and we pull out the stats that we think might help.
And this week, we'll be going underwater and discussing the High Seas Treaty.
Plus, a little bit about sustainable jobs. So we're going to talk about the High Seas Treaty, which made big news in the last week.
And I want to really start with this topic by saying this is actually some relatively good news on the environment for once. Not often do we have subjects which are really positive in this area. So we're going to celebrate it. But to start with, I thought I'd just kind of think about some of the issues the high seas actually faces. So PK, what issues are you familiar with in terms of the high sea? Or do you even know what the high sea is?
Well, I know it was like the Wild West and that almost anything could go outside like 200 miles off the coast of every nation. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's 200 nautical miles. And I can't profess to know what a nautical mile is and how it's different to a regular mile. But I'm sure there's some sort of difference. But yes, yeah, so each country has what we call an exclusive economic zone, an EEZ, around its borders, which goes for, as I say, 200 nautical miles. And this is kind of the area in which that country can operate and has the ability to do whatever it likes in many ways, with a few small exceptions. But then outside of that 200-mile nautical zone, we have the high seas. And this is actually the vast majority of the seas. And until this treaty, almost completely unregulated. So people could kind of do whatever they wanted. Just dump things, destroy things, smash things, with only a few exceptions.
That's actually kind of scary.
Yeah, it's one of those things that all of a sudden you realize, actually, yeah, there's this massive space which no one's policing or looking at, and they're just anything can go. And that is daunting, because this is most of our planet and it's so important for everything.
Yeah, and I was thinking when you were talking about that, I was thinking about big cruise ships, which are basically sort of cities going out to sea and just kind of dump refuse and things like that into the ocean. But it ends up being, instead of being a gigantic landfill, it's a like sea fill.
Yeah.
It's basically become a trash dumping ground.
Yeah. And the high seas and seas generally is faced by a whole host of different problems. Pollution is a major one, obviously, and something you've already addressed there. There's all sorts of different pollutions that go in the sea. The one that I'm sure we're all familiar with is plastic pollution. But there's all sorts of other things that go on as well. There's overfishing. So I've heard stories about off the Welsh coast in the 1800s when the boats couldn't move because of the quantity of fish that surrounded them, whereas now there's barely a thing to catch. And also we've got things like ocean acidification as a result of climate change, where the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere turns into carbonic acid and changes the pH of the sea. And this was kind of one of the first things that actually got me into climate change and environmentalism generally, because the idea of various shell-creating organisms living in an acid bath, which just basically melted their homes, kind of scared me and made me feel like we should probably do something about that, because it seems like a bit of a daunting prospect. But there's issues with sea mining, oil extraction, which goes into the sea, and basically the high seas are just really, really taking the brunt of human impacts.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the ocean acidification. When you brought it back to shellfish, it's essentially is a mechanism that, and this could happen with coral as well, where crabs, lobsters, those kind of animals, they can't build their shells strong enough, which makes them vulnerable, and they can't protect themselves as well. So yeah, that has a terrible impact. And that's just a couple of species.
Yeah. So it's anything which we call a calcifier. So it makes its shell out of calcium carbonate, which can be impacted by this.
So basically our teeth, it would be like if our teeth couldn't form strong enough.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is happening as we speak in the ocean as a result of the things that we've done. And the real premise of this high seas treaty is to transform 30% of the high sea into what we call a marine protected area by 2030. And in these areas, the idea is that we limit the impact of things that are going on. And these can take many different forms. So, for example, it could be kind of no take zones for fishing, no oil zones, or areas where you limit noise, anthropogenic noise, which kind of damages various life forms because it vibrates them. And it's one of those kind of unexplored areas is anthropogenic noise in the ocean. And it can just have major impacts on all sorts of species. interrupting the way they mate, interrupting the way they get food, all sorts of things. So these marine protected areas that are coming from the High Seas Treaty are aiming to kind of disrupt what we've got going at the moment and limit things happening and just generally make the high seas a more pleasant place for all of that biodiversity to thrive.
I like that. I'm glad you also mentioned the noise and communications. I mean, for some of these animals, it's basically like they're living right next to an airport, and how hard that would be if you were trying to communicate, and particularly as they need to communicate over long distances, some of these species as well. Human-produced noise impacts them significantly.
Yeah. And it's something that we can take steps to mitigate in quite simple ways, really, as well. It's not too complex.
What are some of those steps?
Well, it's just in terms of making sure that going through particularly biodiverse areas, engines are turned down, electric engines are used instead of diesel engines and petrol engines because they're noisier. And also things like drilling, especially as you're drilling through the ocean floor, the sound reverberates over a longer distance and can have major impacts across a bigger area. But one of the things I kind of just want to think about as well actually is the benefit that we get from the ocean. Living in the middle of England, I don't see the ocean much anymore, and it's one of the things that I miss the most. And the ocean actually provides loads for us in all sorts of ways. Obviously, there's the really direct things like fishing and livelihoods, but actually provides trillions of dollars worth of what we call ecosystem services. And these are services which kind of regulate everything that our life depends on. This could be things like producing oxygen, regulating the ocean current, so actually where the nutrients flow around the world, or absorbing carbon.
Yeah, all critically important things. I've got some quiz questions about this, which I think I'm getting a sense that you're going to actually blow through the quiz pretty handily today.
I hope they're not on the ecosystem services of whales, because this is a really cool fact. Whales have the potential to be a major store of carbon.
Tell me, this is crazy. I've not heard of this.
So there's a book all about it where they dig into all the facts about, okay, what's the value of a whale? And if you looked at it through carbon terms, a whale can store about 30 tons of carbon throughout its life. So in one way, they create what we call marine snow, which is, to put it nicely, poo, and various bits of debris which falls off the animal. And they collect that from the surface and what they eat. And then as they swim along and they splish splash through their lives, they release waste and they drop various bits of skin, etc. And that sinks to the bottom of the ocean floor and is stored as carbon. And then actually when that whale dies at the end of its life and that goes to the bottom of the ocean, it gets locked in. All the carbon that's inside the whale's body gets locked in the ocean floor. So if we were to actually let whales thrive and their populations boom, they could be a major store of carbon.
That is fascinating. What's that book called? Do you know? If not, we can link it in the show notes.
I can't remember the name of it.
We'll pop it in the show notes.
If you haven't got time to read the whole book as well, there's definitely at least one TED Talks video on it.
Oh, I'm looking for this. So whales and their poo, whales and marine poo. We've actually, this is the second episode that we've tapped onto fecal matter once again. Another issue I've sort of happened upon by listening to this, that yes, this is really great news to get these, I think, 100 and definitely 190. It might be 193, 95 countries.
193
countries to sign off on this treaty. It still has to go through a lot of processes. But one thing that they talked about was ensuring, just like when we have little wildlife zones on land where we have little protection zones, if there aren't corridors where some of these can link up, so you might have a high seas protected area and then the Wild West and then another high seas protected area, but it means the corridor that might be necessary to help facilitate a specific species of being able to go back and forth and mating also needs to have a bit of protection as well. So it's sort of just making sure that we can get the policy and the robust science to follow up with that.
Yeah, if we look at the system we've got at the moment, just outside of the exclusive economic zones, in some places where there's actually a huge, really thriving, massive ecosystem. So for example, places like the Galapagos, there'll be various fishing vessels just waiting on the edge of that marine protected zone because they know they've got such good stocks in there. So they know it's a profitable place to go and sit and just wait for the fish to leave. And especially when you've got migratory species, which just go all over the ocean, if they leave one of these zones, all of a sudden they could be in a place where they could just get taken again. So we might see over-exploitation in other areas as well.
If I understand correctly, so we've got this we can celebrate. We've got this high seas treaty, but there are some further steps that now needs to go through. It needs to be ratified. We need 60 countries to sign off to be able to ratify it. And then apparently a committee will be formed. Dear God, a committee. I am so fearful of committees. But granted, it needs a committee. It needs something to oversee it. And then, of course, you have to have budgets. And then you have mechanisms to, you know, manage that budget. And with any kind of budget, you need like a funding model. You need a policy model. So hopefully, as time goes on, and I think we have to stay on top of this, is just ensuring that all of that does actually happen. Great, we've got this high seas treaty. Let's keep up the momentum. Let's try to get some policies in place and then review the policies. And if they're not working, start to build better policies, but don't not start working on something and putting it in place for these protections. Yeah, so great news is what I'm thinking from the High Seas Treaty. We have to ensure that it keeps going. And what's a step that we can possibly take to ourselves if we want to kind of let government know, please take this seriously?
Well, the most important thing to do now is to get in contact with your MP and tell them that we should definitely be ratifying this. And there is probably some value in doing this. So not only for the biodiversity, but there's also going to be economic value in this for various people to say, yeah, the ocean is something we should definitely protect. One final thing before we move on. The thing that actually blew my mind the most about this when I was like learning about things before the High Seas Treaty was that like anyone can just go out into the high seas and just take things and then they own the stuff that comes from it. Like I was reading about this shark that people think might cure cancer. If you've got a big enough boat, you can be like, yeah, I'll go catch that shark and I'm going to have the cancer cure. Whoever the country it's nearest to is not the owner of that cure. It's just you with your big boat can go out and do it. And it just blew my mind that you're kind of thinking, okay, whoever has the most cash and the biggest boat can go and get all the answers. And then we can make all the money from it. And I think the High Seas Treaty will be good to actually try and maybe balance out in some way the disparity, because there's ideas about having more ownership for the countries and nations which are closest to the point of discovery as well. So, moving on to our next topic then, we're going to have a quick discussion about the idea of sustainable or green jobs. And I know it's something that you've been spoken to a lot of people about before, PK, and it's something that people are very interested in.
Yeah, so this has been coming up more and more. Even the government has mentioned things like the Green Industrial Revolution. I remember when our former PM Boris was in, he was talking about the Green Industrial Revolution, green jobs, etc. And I think for a lot of people, they're not even really sure what that means. So what we did was we ran a program called Green Works Pathways, and we ran a couple of iterations of this. And this was with the nonprofit environmental training company I co-founded. So we got a bit of funding from the Community Fund to run a course to help people who were interested in getting into green industries. At the time, we thought a lot of people might be laid off due to COVID from non-degree or non-highly qualified positions, and we wanted to help those people understand how they could take their current skills and get into different green jobs. But interestingly, the people that actually ended up participating the most were people who had college degrees. So it was sort of twofold. On one side of it, we have people who are interested and looking for work, and then we have actually the jobs available. So going back to these people that had degrees, they were attorneys, nurses, architects, engineers. They still liked their industry. They just didn't want to work in the exact silo that they were in. They wanted to use their skills for a green industry. So through that, we learned a lot. We also connected them with a lot of different green industry work. Aside from that, I've been talking at different universities and colleges, and some of these courses I've been in, the students said, well, really, if you're not in STEM, you can't go into a green career. So understanding the misconceptions from just your average student of, well, I'm majoring in digital media, I can't go into a green career, but trying to help people understand actually almost any job can go into a green career unless you're extracting fossil fuel.
I would even say that the fossil fuel industry needs the transition to be green. So even the fossil fuel industry can be green, and they're going to play a critical role in things like carbon capture and storage. But one thing I was going to jump back a little bit to what you first said there and say, it's interesting that you said it's people that have degrees that have come to you for looking for green jobs. And I wonder if it actually represents more of a more systemic issue here with the way that we look at the environment. So there's quite a middle class thing. And actually kind of it's quite exclusive in terms of people that you kind of have to have a degree to be engaged with it. And I don't know if that's kind of something you've seen everywhere in general.
I think it's more on the radar, certainly for the higher education you are, the more you're exposed to environmentalism, the green industry, etc. But there are actually a whole host of jobs that you don't need any qualifications for that some people just might not even think about. So during the Green Parts Pathways program, we worked with different companies like EVC Solutions, which installs car charge point chargers, if I can get that correctly. They install those poles where you can hook up your EV and charge your car. There we go. But yeah, so we were talking to them and we said, well, you know, what percentage of the jobs in that you guys offer in your own organization require a qualification or degree? And they had just had a management meeting, a senior management meeting. And they said, we just talked about this and we realized that 80% of our jobs require no qualification whatsoever. So you could actually start working in the green industry in that field, and you could actually get the qualifications along the way if you wanted to move up. And I thought that was really great. So we wanted to sort of ensure people understood that. But the jobs I've seen most recently on LinkedIn, which is, I think, where you can get a good idea of what's happening, they all seem to be ESG. I could see why people would think you have to be STEM related or you have to have a specific degree. But really, almost any job, whether it's an admin job or what have you, you just have to kind of decide and look to see what companies are available.
So I guess first of all, it's probably worth clarifying what ESG is. And it's environment, social, governance. And it basically, they're metrics that organizations use to score themselves about how good these things are. How do I put this nicely? Because I'm sure some people like ESG. It's all a load of nonsense and people can just lie to get through the things they want. And actually, it means nothing really because they can just get really good PR people in to come and just give a load of polite word, bad stuff, say, oh, this is fine, doesn't matter. It's something that it's some people see it as important, but I also think we should actually just be focusing on the E of it and just saying we should scrap environment and also say emissions. And then we'll see who's actually good at these things. But there's my rant about ESG, because people always say, oh, it's this wonderful thing, isn't it? No, it's not. It's a load of greenwash. Rant over. Finished. Finito.
Well, it is one of those things where it can feel very much like a PR greenwashing stunt. And I think the hard part is just understanding that a lot of the green jobs might just be greenwashing. And I'll give you an example of even if a company has a corporate sustainability officer, which almost every large global organization now has. And granted, this example I'm going to give you was over 5 years ago. My husband was working for a global entity that would be very name recognizable in the United States and in the UK and some other European countries where they produced, you could get medications there, but you could also get beauty products and things like that in this whole company. And he showed me what their company's sustainability plan was. And again, this was like 5, 6, 7 years ago for 2025. And I looked at it and I remember thinking, this should be done right now. And so again, this was, you know, pre-2020, et cetera. And he said, yeah, that's what I thought. So he had written an email to the chief sustainability officer. And I read it, it was quite firm for a British person. I was surprised, but I was like, wow, okay. She immediately wrote back and said, I want to have a meeting with you. Let's have a meeting. And I thought, wow, this is great. So he goes to have a meeting with her. And this really opened my eyes quite a bit because I wasn't in sustainability at the time, but I had an interest in it. And she was the chief sustainability officer of a multi-billion dollar global company. She was just one person. She didn't have a team underneath her. She had no budget to speak of. It was just basically signposting. So some of these green jobs, I think, are just foo-foo marketing gimmicks. But there are a lot of other green jobs as well that I think you can go into without having a qualification. And so to me, the jury's still out, even though I think there will be more and more green jobs as we have more wind power, solar power, more renewable energy. Also, we need more research, but all of these companies need admin people. They need marketing people. They need people to create their videos. They need people to do the business development. So it might not be a quote unquote green job, but it might be with an organization that is doing green work. When I talk to the uni students, here are a few things I remind them of. I remind them of what they might want the legacy of their work to be. So these are young people that are still starting out in their careers. And to understand what kind of products do they want to be producing in the world, and to keep that in mind while they're on their job searches. And then the tips I would give virtually anybody who is wanting to transition to a green industry or looking for a green industry or doesn't know what they want to do is a couple things. It's basically about networking and raising your awareness. So I think joining a few local groups that are in the sustainability area. So where we are, Tom lives in Staffordshire. I live in Derbyshire, but we do some work across all the borders and across the UK as well. So in Staffordshire, we have the Staffordshire Business Environmental Network, also known as ESPEN. They are a fantastic resource. And if you're outside of Staffordshire, I would still check out their website because there are some events you could attend online for free and you don't even have to be a member. But you can also, through that, start to see some of the companies putting on events, start looking at those companies, seeing what jobs are available with them. There's also Sustainability West Midlands. They are a really great organization as well. Again, they have memberships, but they often have events that you can attend where you don't have to be a member. But through them, just on their website, you can see loads of different companies that you may have never heard of, and you can start clicking on those and exploring those companies, what they do. If they're a member, they probably have a sustainable link. And then additionally, you could start looking on LinkedIn after you've done that, and you definitely need to be on LinkedIn, people. And through that, you can learn a lot about those companies and you can learn what jobs are available and start exploring more. But you could also start networking with these groups of people. There's another group that I'm going to mention, which is called the Women in Sustainability, or WINS. That started off as just a UK group, but during the pandemic, it grew. And now there's groups in New York. There's groups on the continent of Europe. And I found that to be a really great networking group for women who don't even have any sort of degree in sustainability or climate change or that kind of science, but was interested in it as well. It was a really nice and supportive group of women. So that's a group you could join. A lot of those meetings, you don't have to be a member to attend as well. So those are just a few of those resources that I would suggest you try to do if you're interested in sustainability or interested in jobs. Access your local universities. There's lots of things you can do for free. You don't even have to necessarily be a university student. And if you don't live in the areas that Tom and I live in, just do a Google search. What sustainability networking options are available to you? And just start making those connections and expanding your horizons.
Do you want to hear my critique of this?
Yes, Tom. Give me your critique.
I think all of the organizations you've outlined, because I've worked with a few of them before, are absolutely amazing. But I would say they fit into the bracket of middle-class solutionism. They are promoting various things which change the way we consume. So, for example, through things like electric cars and solar panels, that sort of thing, which are obviously needed for the net zero transition and to really take positive action on climate change. Because a lot of the time, people don't want to give up their comforts in life, and they want to live life exactly the same way as they did before, just changing the way they do things. But actually, the major part of sustainability jobs doesn't have the word sustainability in it. It's not going to be people that go and work for an electric car charging company, or it's not going to be someone that installs solar panels, or even has a university degree. And if we think about the UK specifically, the vast majority of green jobs are going to be in construction and manufacturing. Because we need these areas to be net zero if we're going to reach our targets. So just a few quick figures here. 1 in 5 workers in the UK will be affected by the net zero transition. And that's around about 6.3 million jobs. And 3 million of those jobs will be people that require upskilling, like completely change the way they're working. So, for example, if we're thinking about construction now, we use things like cement, which are high carbon in nature. But then actually, there's going to be about 3 million high demand jobs again as a result of the transition. And again, these are areas like wholesale, mining and utilities, transport and storage, motor trades. And then the actual areas where there's a lot less demand over the long runs is things like education, health, finance, insurance, these university-based jobs. So really, the people that need to be engaged with this aren't necessarily going to be the folks that are targeted by these organizations at the moment. And if we're going to fill this massive, massive skills gap we have at the moment, we need to refocus our efforts to those areas which are going to be really demanded, especially in manufacturing and construction, to reach our targets. Critique complete.
So when you think about it, of 20% of the job market will be impacted by the net zero targets. And I like that you actually brought in the construction element of it as well. And we've seen this where the government launches a scheme where you can get reimbursed or we'll pay 80% of something that allows you to have this green thing done in your home. But yet they didn't let the people who normally would install these things in your home know far enough in advance that they could ensure a good portion of their workforce. They didn't let me know enough in time that I could get 20% of my work team or my employees qualified to install XYZ. So sometimes there's money left on the table because there aren't enough workers to deliver on this scheme that the government has launched. But the government can say, we did this scheme, we offered this, but not everyone took us up on it. When in fact, people would take you up on it, but there wasn't a labor force that had the qualifications and skills to deliver on it.
Yeah. And I think it's also just generally kind of making sure people are aware of these things that are going to be coming. So, for example, on my estate, people came around and offered free cavity wall and loft insulation as part of a government scheme. Across the people that lived in my little area, we were the only people that took it because people just didn't trust the workforce to be able to deliver something of a high quality, and they didn't trust the environmental aspects of all these things. And fundamentally there was a real gap in terms of, okay, there's demand for these things but not through an environmental lens. So coming at these challenges through sustainability and environment alone won't A, create the demand for services, which will then also drive the jobs. So we need to be thinking about things from multiple different angles to get buy-in across demographic groups as well. In my opinion, I could well be wrong.
Actually, I think from a behavior standpoint, you're absolutely correct. So for people like you and I, we might be like, let's get that loft installation. We want to protect the environment. For somebody else, the pitch might be, you will save 27% on your heating bills. So maybe if that had been pitched that way, more people would have taken that up. That's really stunning that, you know, you were the only people that took that.
Yeah. And I'd also just say as well, like there's an absolutely amazing resource out there in Climate Outreach, which is a climate comms group. And they basically just kind of help you communicate with any person and also look at the narratives which are kind of working at the moment to help people either be convinced that we should do something or actually understand people where they are. Because going out there and just pushing in the environment, like I've got a lot of experience in this area and people just dismiss you. And it's only when you actually start talking their language that people say, oh, yeah, I understand where you're coming from now.
You've just got to see what really motivates and will move that person. And almost always there is something that could link back to be something good for the environment that even if they don't care about the environment, there's another positive benefit to them in some way or some form.
I think I'd also say as well, actually, every job needs to be a green job in the future.
Well, I'll give you one quick statistic or piece of data that I thought was really interesting. So in 2015 on LinkedIn, the ratio of U.S., this is U.S., oil/gas jobs to renewable/environment jobs was 5-1. But in 2020, this was down to 2-1. Now, some of those environmental jobs, who knows what they are, but at least there are some jobs out there and it's increasing.
I'll tell you one of the bits of news which made me really happy recently, and I probably shouldn't say this. It's when the fossil fuel companies, when they're going through their graduate schemes, they can't get any graduates to take their jobs because the graduates are starting to say, oh yeah, we don't want to do this anymore. We don't want to perpetuate something which is literally going to put us on the edge of an existential crisis. And I think that shows like the mindset shift, especially in the younger generation, of the sorts of jobs people are looking for, because environment and climate is kind of forefront of their mind. P.S. The information about jobs came from Pecan's work, so Pecan City's work.
In southern United States, we see pecan. So, Tom, we are now at the quiz element of the show. What percentage of sea life is at risk of extinction by 2100? if greenhouse gas emissions are not curbed significantly.
What a jolly way to start the quiz, eh?
Yeah, with mass extinction, yeah.
I'm going to say 40% and be optimistic and say at least half the sea life does not have a calcium carbonate shell to be destroyed by the ocean's acid.
Well, in fact, 90%, according to an international team of researchers, that is, and this was produced in the journal Climate, Nature Climate Change, 90% of all marine life on Earth will be at risk of extinction by 2100 if greenhouse gas emissions are not curbed. That's quote.
And that's why we call it the sixth extinction, eh?
Yeah, yeah. Yay, humans. We're so amazing.
Well, saying that, only 5 times in Earth's history has there been extinction events like the one we're entering. So if nothing, we'll have a legacy on the geological record.
Every animal on the planet, they're hoping for a wipeout pandemic. Okay. How much of the oxygen that we need does the ocean produce? 25%, 50%, 18%.
Oh, I would have definitely gone higher than those. I feel like there's a lot of ocean plankton which create oxygen. So I'm going to go for the highest option, which is 25%.
We've got 25, 50, and 18.
Oh, 50. Ah, 50. Yeah, go 50. Let's go 50.
Correct. So, and this is according to the UN and their aquaculture sector. All right. How many people worldwide depend on fish for protein? I am going to give you some choices. 153 million, 3.3 billion, 1.8 billion.
I think I remember reading something once upon a time, but it could well have been a dream, that half of the world's population depends on the oceans for their food. So I'm going to go lock in answer B, final answer, please.
Yes, you're correct. So it's nearly, so we're at about 8 billion planet-wide right now. So about 3.3 billion depend on fish as their main source of protein. Another reason why we should stop depleting fish so much and ensure that fish get to reproduction levels and be able to reproduce. And this is also from a mega study collated by the UN. All right. How many endangered loggerhead turtles and critically endangered leatherback turtles drown annually on long lines that are set to capture tuna, swordfish, and a few other fish?
It's meant to be a lighthearted podcast. This is horrific.
But this actually goes to why we need to protect certain areas of the ocean. And for people who don't know what long lines are, those are lines that go for a while. They sit on top of the water and they capture tuna, swordfish, and other fish. But that means other species also get tangled up in them. So 250,000 a year, 300,000, or 100,000?
I hope the answer is an invisible one and it's D0. But I've got a feeling it's going to be the high one, and I'm going to go for C.
It was 250,000, but I think the highest one I gave you was 300. So you did get that wrong. That's just what we can guesstimate from doing statistics. And this is from the World Wildlife Fund and their annual reporting.
God, that is really depressing.
It is really depressing because I think for a lot of us, we're thinking of things like, tuna, it's healthier. But we don't realize the way that certain things are, unless you're out there with your own little fishing line, which granted, I know everybody can't do that. The bycatch impacts of our seafood desire is really actually quite bad, sadly, and is actually killing other species that, you know, just die so that we can have tuna fish.
I'm also fairly sure that most ocean plastic comes from fishing vessels as well. So various nets that are disposed of, that sort of thing. Ghost fishing gear, as they call it.
Yep, 47%, I think about half is due to ghost fishing gear, and that the number one threat, according to biologists and scientists, to small mammals such as small whales, dolphins, and porpoises is entanglement in this fishing gear. So that's actually considered the number one threat. Nothing else, just our fishing gear for our fish. All right, so another exciting one also, not necessarily a happy one. The recent report by the UN said that, you know, we're at a critical point. Before, in about 2015, the global scientists had said, by the year 2100, we need to keep the global average temperature rising at 1.5 at the most to mitigate those impacts. Well, now the scientists have said we may reach that in 2030. Now, at 2 degrees, What percentage of the world's coral reefs are estimated to be destroyed with a 2-degree increase in temperature?
I know this one's bad. This is one of the things that I remember from some of the big reports that came out a few years ago. And they've got these bars on them, and they go from red to bad, and purple means extraordinarily bad. And coral was definitely in that purple zone. I reckon it's in the 90%, 92, 95% of coral's gone.
I'm going to give you that. So a warming of 1.5 threatens to destroy 70 to 90% of coral reefs. 2% means nearly 100% loss, which is actually beyond the point of no return, according to the United Nations data. So 2-degree rise in sea temperatures, virtually the coral seas will be, any coral will be gone.
Well, at least when I'm crying myself to sleep tonight, I'll still be able to remember I did okay on the quiz.
This is depressing. But again, the good news is it really illustrates why the High Seas Treaty is so, so, so important. There's something in native tribes and native cultures where they think the decisions they make now, they think, how will this impact 7 generations down the road? And I really like that way of thinking. They'll be saying, wow, those people in 2023 really got it right. We're so grateful to them.
And now it's been boycotted by a washing brand, which is called 7 Generations. So it made me sad because I've heard it's like a Native American phrase, and it's like, oh, now I see it in the supermarket. Okay, so it's that time in the show to move on to any other business. PK, have you got anything you want to say?
Well, yeah, actually, we got a really nice message and interesting question from Darcy about the flights I took in, mentioned in our last episode, where when I looked back at the year of 2016, it was 12 return flights from Amsterdam to the UK. These were flights I was coming back to see my family. You know, at the time, our lovely little lad was 9. So it was a once a month trip to come back. I could never leave the office before 5, so I probably wouldn't have booked a flight until 7:30. And then I had to be back in Amsterdam, I would say, by before midnight on Sunday so that I could get a good night's sleep because work was quite demanding. Someone did say, well, surely the Eurostar would have been much, much, much faster. Gosh, I don't actually remember this, but I looked up, if I did do this today, my trips were initially for the flight was leaving about 7:30 from Schiphol Airport, flying to Manchester Airport often, doing that flight, then taking the train from Manchester to Stoke-on-Trent, where my now husband would drive up about 40 minutes and drive home. 5.5 hours could be that trip. However, to do the Eurostar, if I were to do it this week, the fastest trip I found was 12 hours. So I probably did explore this in 2016 and just chucked it immediately as a non-doer. But if we could get faster rail, more opportunities for rail, and rail that happened more frequently, then these could become viable options for people. So yeah, that's the feedback from that.
Well, luckily with HS2, you can arrive 15 minutes earlier, only at the expense of 17 pristine ancient woodlands, which we'll never be able to recover.
Yeah. By the way, Darcy runs the fabulous Refills on the Road, where she has this fantastic van. She goes to other towns that often don't have zero waste shops, and she is their zero waste option.
And if you want to find out any more about aviation, and even if aviation can be sustainable, go back to episode 2.
And if, like me, you may have a bit of flight anxiety, there's a great organization called takethejump.org. And you can go to their website and they have a little area called Holiday Local and making you feel a bit better about how many flights you can take and still have a relatively decent carbon footprint.
Thanks again for listening. If you do have any thoughts on what we've discussed in today's episode,
or if you'd like to suggest some topics for future episodes,
email hello@theecocentrics.com.
Or you can look us up on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, also as The Ecocentrics.
And remember to hit follow so you never miss an episode.
See you next week. Ciao.
Bye. This podcast is produced by Emma Newman, no relation to Paul Newman. And I've forgotten Morgan's surname. And music was done by...
the memorable Morgan J. Bryan.
I think I need Morgan's name like posters somewhere so I can have it. And just maybe a picture as well, actually.